On this week's show, Build It Yourself or Buy It Off the Shelf with Samantha Ehrlich and Kirsty Nurka from Ellis Don.
Construction is the world's oldest industry but spends the least amount of money on innovation. When we realized people outside the construction industry didn't typically associate construction with technology like virtual reality, apps, and robotics, we started the ConTech Crew. Each week, we bring our listeners the latest in ConTech news and interview the minds behind the technological innovations changing the way we build. So strap in, enjoy the ride, and geek out. It's ConTech Crew time.
All right, we're back. We're trying something new. It's just me and the guests, and we've got two in the view. So we're going to start with Samantha. Samantha, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing good, Jeff. How are you?
I'm good. And to your right, we have Kirsty. Kirsty, how are you doing this morning?
I'm good.
So this is truly innovative because we're doing this with me in my office and they're sharing an office together. Now, where are you guys? You're not down here in the U.S. Where are you?
No, we're in Mississauga, which is just about half an hour west of Toronto.
Okay. So see, we got more Canadians on the show. We're going to grow our Canadians to the North's participation. We're going to dive into this episode. We're going to have a whole lot of fun. We'll be right back. Are you trying to reach the innovators and decision makers in construction technology? Then look no further than sponsoring the ConTech Crew. That's right. We're taking new advertisers. Email us at advertising@theconTechCrew.com to learn more. All right. So I'm really excited about this. We got connected through Hamad Chaudhry with, if you guys have listened to the show, Hamad was on not too long ago. So you can kind of roll back and get an understanding of what Ellis Don as a company, but also as kind of a focus on innovation is. But he opened up Pandora's box and said there was a little more going on in the background. So I'm excited to have you two at the table today to talk about it. Samantha, talk to me about your background and how you got here, and then we'll kind of jump into Kirsty's as well.
Yeah, definitely. So I started Ellis Don in early 2016, but before that, I did civil engineering at Queen's, which is a university just about 2 hours east of Toronto. I actually did my fourth year design project with Ellis Don, where we kind of connect through some of the construction sciences groups within the company to help with like our fourth year design project. And I really like the people I work with and I love the company and definitely made it a focus to figure out how to connect back with Ellis Don and join after graduating. Was not expecting to join the technology group though. That was definitely a surprise. And when I started, I was more on the consulting side. So the idea of looking at all the different software that we had available, including our proprietary project management system, Gate 3, and helping the project teams to basically utilize those platforms on site. And that was the focus of my career for the first 3 years or so. And then I moved into product management in around 2018 to get to the role I am today, which is the director of product. And basically, the team I work with is dedicated to building out all types of products, including Gate 3, and still up and running and basically hosting all of our project teams across the country. And we develop some other tools too, which I'm sure we'll get into later in the show.
Yeah, it's awesome. And I'm going to have you guys kind of dive in a little bit more, because when everybody listening heard product and project, they're thinking something completely different than where we're going to take it. That's why I thought this was so cool. So Kirsty, let's flip it over to you. How did you get here?
So I joined Ellis Don in 2018, and I was the first UX designer to join the tech side of Ellis Don, which was pretty exciting. But before that, I studied industrial design at OCAD University, which is an art and design university in Toronto. Did a minor in wearable technology. And I was just, I mean, industrial design is very hands-on. You're building products in the wood shop, metal shop. But here is just all through your computer, which was just another take on user experience that I wanted to tackle. And when I joined Ellis Don, everything was very new to everybody, right? Like it was a fairly new product, and there was no other designers, barely any developers. So we've come a long way. I actually left for a bit to explore, to get other experiences. And then I came back as a UX manager, and I think everything has been amazing ever since.
That's awesome. I mean, there's a lot of folks listening to, and I think the industrial design with a minor in wearable might be one of the coolest education paths I've ever heard. What got you into wanting to do those two things together? Like, how does that come together?
I actually didn't know I wanted to do those two together until probably third year university. But wearable tech was like emerging technology, right? It wasn't explored enough. And around my third year, it was, I was hearing all these like news and articles and everything about wearable tech. And it wasn't just, people think it's only like watch, like Apple Watch or, you know, headphones, noise canceling, but there's a lot more to that. Like you can, my focus was on healthcare. So I explored a lot there. And I think now at Elizdon, we're also exploring a lot of these emerging tech, which we can definitely talk about in this podcast.
Yeah, I think it's so cool because it does. Like the early wearables, we were having a look at them in other areas and say, how could this work in construction? And you've come over here. Now everybody listening is like, wait a second. Are we talking to a software company or are we talking to a construction company? And here's the interesting thing. The answer is yes, we're talking to both. And it's no secret that I have been out there for a long time talking about maybe not building things yourself so much, because we see this quite often in the industry where, you know, something maybe doesn't exist or, you know, you have a certain process or certain way you do things and you talk about building it yourself. And I'm pretty anti in most cases because there's a lot of structure. There's a lot that goes into this. So let's talk about how did Elizdon even decide to make this? And let's sort of remove some of the thoughts of, I always call this two dudes in a garage is not, that is not your development team. So
it's not our story either, for sure.
Yes. And it's no coincidence that it's not two dudes, that we actually brought two women on the show to talk about scaling and having, you know, a true background and education in this. So tell me a little bit about how Elizdon got here, and then we'll really dive into, you know, what the structure looks like.
Yeah, 100%. For those who have not heard of Elizdon or are unfamiliar with the company, we were founded in 1951. So hitting almost 75 years in the construction industry, we were actually one of the first companies, if not the first, to bring a crane into Canada, I believe. So there's some pretty cool history that we have in the country.
Actually,
I think the first, yeah. And then getting into our technology history, it starts in the late 80s, actually. So we built the, it's called the Rogers Center now, but it was the Sky Dome when it was originally built. It was the first retractable roof stadium in the world. And that project was by far the first mega project that Elizdon had ever decided to work on. And I think it was at that point that was like the point at which we knew we needed to do something differently in terms of how we were executing project management. The paper-based solution was no longer going to be the only thing we could do. And taking on, you know, these types of mega projects, we needed something more sophisticated. So in the early 90s, we started investing in accounting tools, but we weren't going to use off the shelf because, as you know, progressive billings don't exist really in accounting tools. Especially in the early 90s, like there wasn't a lot out there. So we got an instance of an IBM tool and basically started building our own construction accounting platform in the early 90s. And that is the inception of what we'll now call our digital data engineering group at Elizdon, which is running over 200 strong.
Yeah. Okay. So digital data and engineering, we're going to come back to that. It's really crazy that was the impetus for Elizdon itself, obviously predates all of us, you know, making this decision to move down and build. Because I was just at a Construction Financial Management Association meeting, and I can tell you today that there is no ERP that exists in our world. And I think the reason for that is the unique needs of accounting and and then the parts and pieces that go on top of it that don't align with the way other ERPs work. Like construction's just so different. So it is interesting that that's where you started. Now it grew quite a bit. So now you just called it. So you're the digital data and engineering team. Is that what your guys are called?
Correct. And that's made up of, you know, a representation of individuals who work on software development, but it's also made up of Hamad's group, who you previously mentioned, mm-hmm. And a lot of individuals who work in our visual design and construction team, building out BIM models. It includes things like traditional hardware support for the entire business, our security team, our coast-to-coast support, like tech desk. So there's a lot that's included in that 200, but about 80 people work on our in-house ERP tool.
So about 80 developers total on the in-house ERP.
So not just 80, developers.
Not developers, 80, 80 people. I said that developers, yeah. I meant 80 people in the development
yes.
of, because yes. that leans to, you know, bringing someone like Kirsty in to 100%. Who's focused on UI UX. This is something most of our construction companies that are going down this route forget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that what you've built? And that's why I wanted to kind of highlight the industrial design and wearables, you know, what that brought as a UI UX. What do you bring, Kirsty, and why is that role important? Because you were the first.
When we talk about if we wanted to buy something off shelf or design in-house, I think that's one of the most important things is if you buy off shelf, sure, we might get something into the market a lot faster because there's already an existing company that does this, right? But for us, the lack of user experience, if you get someone off shelf was like, I think the user experience is probably non-existent for hiring another company to do our work. So the way we built it was with the user experience in mind. I think most of our, we have a lot of users that we talk to internally, so we can iterate constantly. And if we iterate constantly, that means that we don't need to actually launch and then get feedback. We do everything at once, which helps a lot.
Yeah. And this was something we did not learn overnight. Like following that 1990s story, we basically spent the next 25 years, I guess, figuring out how to integrate ourselves properly with the operation side, right? Like it was a language barrier in a way because they're speaking construction and we're speaking technology, and to figure out how to connect those two pieces together, it's going to take a very agile type of discovery process. Not only that, but the complexity of construction and the projects that they work on, and even the fact that we're, you know, a multi-language company, coast to coast, and actually multinational company. And those things are very difficult to code into a single platform. So how do we embrace the diversity of Ellis Dawn and everything that we have to offer and build a tool that's going to work for everybody?
We actually did try, I think, to hire someone else to do this.
Oh yeah, we did.
A while ago. We're talking like back in 2017, 2018.
We had an external suite of devs and UX before Kirsty was hired to do the in-house.
It just didn't click.
It's easier to have it in your own team for sure.
Well, that's a unique perspective, right? The one thing that gets me about people trying to do this is usually it's just a couple of people. There's not, you know, the rigor and experience. What I didn't realize before we got into this is that this is a 35 year or more process. So it's showing to everyone listening that like this didn't happen overnight. It's not like in 2019, you decided, meh, none of this off the shelf stuff works. We know what we're doing. We're just going to spin this sucker up. It's been going on for a long time. The organization's been iterating and changing, and you know, to 2017 to think about, you know, outsourcing some of it. That's again, it's an iteration, it's an experience, and it's going, okay, that failed. So mm-hmm. we're going to bring this in house, probably for all those reasons, right? There, it's very hard for someone external to get plugged into the nuance and the complexity of what an organization like yours does, especially because, you know, you guys work multinational, you work across Canada, and you work on extremely different types of projects, right? You have a number of different verticals that you're in. So,
and to add to that, even Jeff, obviously we're a general contractor first and foremost, but we also do a lot of self-perform work. And so we can also be the subcontractor, and the diversity of those portfolios as well is the complexity to add into the layers of the system. So with, you know, that cradle to grave services that we offer through Ellis Dawn, again, that just explains even to another degree of why we should host this in-house. Because when we onboard someone new to our team, trying to explain to them what we build and how we build it is probably the most difficult learning curve to overcome. It's just, what is Ellis Dawn? And it's, you know, the answer to that is changing every day, which makes it more fun, but there's no lack of innovation in this company for sure.
So let's take a step back and think about the design and the development process. So, and I want to incorporate the, do we build it or do we buy it process? So step me through, the organization identifies a problem. I mean, first of all, how does that even work? I mean, are you guys involved in identifying, you know, problems that might exist? How does that all work? And then let's step through like how it becomes a solution, because Ellis Dawn is known for buying, you know, pieces of software that to fulfill, you know, to fill out the stack. So you're not just we build everything ourselves. We look at nothing else. By the way, there are a couple of companies out there that's the way they operate. I think absolutism in either perspective is probably not a good idea. So let's step through, how does Ellis Dawn and your team and everyone go about identifying problems and then stepping through what we're going to do about it?
I think one of the first things to just think about is that, like, there's no shortage of ideas. Right. There's 5,000 people at this company. I'm sure all of them have a way that they think that we could build a tool to make their lives easier. And I'm sure they're all right. It's figuring out what to do with that enormous amount of innovation and which ones would make sense to implement. And to your point, are we building it or are we buying it? So from a use case perspective, we're receiving ideas constantly, whether it's through the platform directly, whether it's through just conversations. Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that we start off with 100% is, do we have a tool already in-house that can accommodate your needs? So we have a pretty robust software selection process that's been implemented. And that group basically handles all intake requests for any new tool. And that's not part of our team, but it's part of the digital team overall. And just a stat, in 2023, we had over 126 new software requests come through. So this is a huge intake process, and we review from a security perspective, a legality perspective, a function perspective, and then is it overlapping with the roadmap of any of the tools that we already have in our possession or are building? And the complexity of that is obviously overwhelming, and it's really critical we work really close with these other groups to ensure that what we're identifying as problems we want to build solutions for is not overlapping with the tools that we're looking at.
All right, that covers a lot. First, I mean, I love the legal and security, right? Most people forget that if you don't start with legal and security, right, you start building things that are going to get you in trouble, right? You begin with the end in mind, and the end has to be, it's a legal tool, right? And it's secure, right? It's
absolutely.
It's got to fulfill your security needs. So great place to start. But how do you keep track? Because the tools that you have are far reaching. How do you keep track of the scope of what the tools that you have today cover to even decide, oh, do we have something for this or don't we?
It's not a clear delineation, but there is a delineation between the tools that we're looking at on the market and what we build with Gate 3 and its peripheral tools, because we focus very specifically on the project management and operations. And you know, some of these tools are things for like the BIM modeling scope, like we are not going to be building any kind of BIM modeling tool. So there are some very clear situations, and then there's the ones that get a little bit more interesting. And it really does become a discussion of, okay, we could build this. Maybe it's not a priority right now and we can pilot something on the market.
Put in the backlog.
It really depends on the use case, the cost. Yeah. There's so many factors that contribute to the build versus buy. But we can definitely get into, when we decide to build it, what happens. And that's
all right.
100% where her team is super critical with any new use case we decide to integrate into our platform.
Well, I think it's kind of, I'll kind of sum it up, because I think it's important to sum up, especially for some of these groups, is you're not building modeling software, right? You're not building, you know, reality capture scanners and, you know, those types.
Tools.
Yeah.
None of that stuff.
Yeah. Those types of things. So there's a scope that it's going to go through the process. And if it's come in, so now we've selected it. So we've decided this is something we're going to build. What does that process look like?
Yeah. So after the whole strategy and the product requirements have kind of been completed, we go into the actual discovery phase of the product development cycle. Basically, the discovery phase is where we sit down with the UX team, Sam, the product owners, some of the developers, and we just start discussing what a MVP, like a minimal viable product will look like. That's something that we can get on the market. We can develop quicker, get on the market quicker, but also it needs to hit a certain amount of requirements before we release it. After that discovery session is kind of complete, that's where the UX team kind of takes over a little bit. They work on the concept sketches, the designs overall, the user experience. So it could just be a simple wireframe that you're building. And then you get into the user interviews. And that's where we really sit down and talk to all of our users, especially if it's someone that has requested this before. You would want to sit down with them and see if we're on the right track. And that's where the iterations come in, right? Like if there's a lot of feedback, then we reiterate right away. That will save us a lot of time, resources, and money when we actually launch the product. So once we iterate, we continue to design high fidelity mockups. And then again, user testing, it's like an ongoing process.
Yeah.
I don't know how many times we do that, but it has to be done. So,
and this can be in a process as short as a design sprint. Like we've hosted many design sprints at Ellis Dawn where, are you familiar with the design sprint, Jeff?
But explain that to the listeners, because I am.
Absolutely.
But explain that.
So it's a Google concept that...
it's like a four-day, five-day
process.
All right, you sit in a room for 4 or 5 days with the users, with our product owners, designers, and you just talk about the problems. And you try to find an opportunity through these problems. This is done through different like research methodologies. Like there's different exercises, and then at the end, the goal is to find the goal of the product and the goal of the design sprint. So if the goal of the design sprint is to come up with a minimum viable product, then that's what we're going to try and come up with. And the reason why they do design sprints is exactly this reiteration. Instead of us building it right away, we're designing with our users in the room and iterating as we go.
And allowing for that rapid innovation, right?
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, well, and the quick feedback loop, right? Like fail early, fail often. It's so unique that you can, as an organization and as a development team, actually have your end user in the room. Most software companies have hired a person who's had an experience in this area or has interviewed people that have these experiences, but is working in some sort of, I wouldn't call it a cave, but off on their own, isolated from the end, what will be the end user. You're saying bring them together and iterate there. But what I think is also cool about that is, you know, you've done some requirements gathering. So through the process, you've taken in the input, you've understood what the business now wants out of this. So you sort of have an MVP of business requirements. So again, it's taking some of the difficulty off. Like we know our requirements. Okay, so now let's get in here and figure out how the software itself can flow and where our opportunities are. And hey, we can have a really bad idea that just dies quickly and goes, or who knows, you can have like an off the wall idea that all of a sudden catches fire because the end user didn't think of that before because you come from the design mindset, right? This is the beauty of the business and design mindset coming together.
Absolutely. And we're really lucky to have a pool of extremely dedicated end users, at least 100 of them sprinkled throughout the business that are, some have been working with us for almost a decade, just trying to make sure that we're developing tools that less focused on meeting their specific needs, but the needs of the business overall and encouraging digitization in new areas. We obviously are very lucky to have that so close to us. And then the other thing that you touched on, which was around that rapid iteration and experience and the failing, we just want to make sure that what we're building is actually going to meet their needs. And building it in isolation, and especially with the complexity of construction, like, it's never going to work. And so one of the focus areas for us as well in the last few years has been upskilling our development team to understand construction, basically. So we've run a series of 20 construction 101 sessions, from everything from pursuits, estimating, scheduling. We did site tours. We talked through how to run a cost forecast. And we want to make sure that our quality engineers, our data scientists, our data engineers, our developers, our DevOps, everybody has a really simplified understanding, at least, of what construction workflow looks like. Obviously, to teach them everything that our project teams know would be an impossibility. But having them, at least at a surface level, understand and empathize with the end user is really important. So that was a big focus for us in the last 2 years, trying to get that upskill underway.
I love the idea of upskilling into the industry, because it gives, again, the UI UX designers who have a completely different background an empathy for what they're building, but also an understanding. It unlocks a lot of, oh, well, I didn't ever realize that, you know, when we go from bidding through pre-con and estimating and into bidding, and then now we've got, you know, we've got an accepted bid, what happens and where does it go? Because there's all this stuff that happens before. And then eventually all this digital things you've done get deployed on a job site, and like, things have to be built. And that is what is unique about the industry. So it creates it. But you hit on something. So you have, obviously, you guys have your area of expertise and you have developers, but you just mentioned DevOps, data scientists, and a couple of other things. So talk about sort of the skill sets that it requires across your organization, just your portion of this organization, to support building a truly integrated tool.
Yeah. I mean, as Kirsty mentioned, like, it starts really at the UX team and the product team. We do have, you know, full stack and back-end developers. We have dev managers. We have data architects. We have QAs, both automated and manual QAs. We have DevOps. We have training. We have support. And we have security. And all of those teams have their own pockets, but all understand overall the goal of the execution and the evolution of the product. And keeping everybody in that same mindset is a full-time gig, absolutely. And you're also talking about not just one product being delivered at a time. We actually have six teams. Yeah. So each of those six teams has their own unique product that they're looking to deliver. And we have six streams of work happening all at the same time.
But also they come into like different phases of the whole development process, right? So 100%. We're big on collaboration. Because if you're not talking to another team that's going to take it on the next phase, then you're failing right there, right? You have to be having conversations back and forth.
Well, this is where it's interesting, because this is where construction building in the physical world and building in the digital world are so similar, right? Literally, the only difference really is that, fortunately for the technology side, gravity doesn't have to be respected. So you can build the front end without the back end, or the back end without the front end. You know, in construction, we have to build with gravity in mind, because, you know, you got to have a great foundation to go upward. But outside of that, this is where we're really, really similar. Is too much of what was broken in software was broken in construction. We would work in our little world and then we'd hand it over and not understand what the next group that was going to receive it needed to do. And there was tons of rework and a lot of things that were just silly. Like, it's like, no one's ever going to do that. That's just completely unusable. Why would you have gone this far down that route? Whereas if everybody was talking, you'd have been able to iterate through and make it connect. Yep. So it's kind of cool to see both of you kind of coexisting through some of those areas. Back in 2020, I heard about a new software platform called Join. Within minutes of seeing Join, I knew it had the power to revolutionize collaborative project delivery. Join is now used by 50% of the ENR top 30. Why? Pre-con and ops leaders at DPR, Bolt, McCarthy, Barton Mallow, Clark, and others say that they like Join because it does two big things: collaborative, trackable decision-making, and awesomely simple visuals. Want to learn more about the power of Join? Go to www.join.build/demo to learn about how better gets built.
No, absolutely. And if we spend enough time making sure that the different teams understand what each other are doing, it also allows them to think more holistically for the product. So if I'm building product A and product B is eventually going to take advantage of all of my endpoints and actually integrate that into their tool or their product, building it from the onset and understanding what those dependencies are. And we talk a lot about dependencies because Gate 3 itself is about 40 modules, and the complexity ranges in everything from, you know, tracking meeting minutes all the way to doing your subcontractor and prime billings. So it's a very complicated tool. And obviously every day it's evolving. So there's no lack of improvement and opportunity that we can do.
So we've built this tool, 40 modules, lots of data. You have data scientists, you know, and I want to highlight too that you mentioned having QA and DevOps, and those are really important pieces too that get forgotten a lot. You develop it all. You've got to continually test it and make sure it doesn't. Every software has bugs. We know that. But yeah, the idea is to limit the number of bugs that get out, and also look for those showstoppers and create an environment in which you can iterate through them and make sure you're releasing quality. I say that here, not that I need to tell you guys that, but there are a lot of folks listening that need to understand that, like, this is a 360 that you must do consistently. And I love automated and personal testing, you know, having individuals that creatively know how to break things. It's a great, you know, I have a background in QA myself, so it's creatively, how can you break it?
And not just like the QA process is so important when you think about what you said, the parallels between construction and development as well, right? So you're thinking about the mockups that they're building offsite and how that's really similar to the process that the UX team is doing, all the way to when we actually do the test-driven development on the dev side. And then you're doing performance testing to make sure if 1,000 people click this button at once, it's not going to break. And that if they click it, this set of use cases is basic, or the test cases is basically aligned with what their expectations are. And then there's the manual testing, because users will do anything they want and won't follow process. So it's important to kind of cover all those bases. And actually, I had a stat here that in the last 2 years, since we've been doing all of our automated performance testing, we've had a 62% decrease in our bug counts year over year.
There we go.
So it's been really interesting to see how AI has also played a part in that as well. And figuring out, you know, things like GitHub Copilot and all these different tools that are now available to our devs, and how we can automate some of the more tedious parts of their work, and allowing them to, you know, focus so much more on the delivery of something amazing to our users.
Oh, that, okay. You're going to take me off script here. I would go down this route of like, we should interview your developers so they could talk to our field about how AI is here to amplify and assist and not replace them. Because that's consistently what I hear is it, you know, in fact, and of course, clickbait's clickbait, right? But everybody, I saw this other way. This AI's, you know, cost or replaced 4,000 jobs. And I'm like, okay, A, how many of those jobs were filled at the time they were replaced? And how many of those people did you replace, or did you promote them to something else? Because the AI is, you know, better at that. And we need a human to do other things. So
yeah, I actually have a quote from one of our devs who basically said, to me, it's like a calculator for math. Once you get used to it, it's hard to code without it.
There you go.
I think it's just about, you know, taking away any kind of monotony, like copying and pasting code to just change a few variables in a component, to building out and just spending your time on more interesting aspects of your work. And I think for those who are willing to augment their role with AI, they'll find new purpose, right? That, I think that's the point of it.
I mean, I use it all the time for design. That's
me too.
It's so good now. Like, it gives me visuals of things that I don't need to be doing. I need to focus on other things. So
Yeah. And it, I mean, it's critical, like 90% of a daily report or a time card or, you know, crew time, lots of things could be automated so that it's like, oh no, this person isn't here today. That's gone. Replace it with this person. But hey, I had most of this laid out already. Oh, hey, you were working in these areas yesterday. Are you still working in those areas? Oh, you've moved to here. Do you want me to move everybody to there? Yeah, I want you to move everybody. Wow, automation. I can get back to making sure I have my materials, making sure I have all the other stuff. So
everyone's safe, all the important things.
Right. So we went that route. Now, what I want to bring you back to is this is not cheap. Okay. So there has to be business value. So how is Ellis Don justifying the amount of investment and the amount of time, and what are the returns that they're seeing? Because obviously we're 30 years down the road with this. They're invested. They would have probably killed it at some point had it not had value. So what are the values currently? And, you know, what do you see and how do you see the organization using it?
So it's a complicated question, no doubt. But you talked, you know, I'll start with risk mitigation, because owning your own proprietary solution definitely mitigates you from cost inflation and things like that, right? But I mean, you know, we're still using external cloud services that we can't get away from. We're not building many of these components, even something like GitHub or Jira, which is our task management tool. There are still tools we use to build the tool, right, that all have cost. But when you talked about the ROI, I mean, number one thing I can think of is because of our 20 years, it's been about 20 years of a sophisticated development team in-house, we're now able to actually sell our services under a new company. It's called Building Digital. We've been, I think it's about a year since we launched, and we're actually able to help other construction companies digitize because of the knowledge between everything you said, our cybersecurity, our data understanding, our empathy to the end user and what they're going through. And those services would not be able to be in place without the knowledge and expertise that we have built over the last 20 years. And for us, digitizing our supply chain is it's an advantage for us as well, because the more that we can help our subcontractors and our peripheral companies digitize, the more efficient we can work all together.
I like that.
That's a big ROI.
It's a huge ROI, and we see this. I mean, I'll bring this to the listeners to their day to day. This is why mechanical contractors have spent their time opening up their fabrication shops, opening up their processes to show other mechanical contractors how to fabricate, because they know that if their competition is fabricating, then they're all working on a fabrication plane instead of having to fight with stick builders. So if your partners and others are digitized, you're not dealing with a paper process that I can't imagine what it's like for a general contractor of your size to work with trade contractors that still have paper or send a million emails to give you the information that you need. Like this, there's so much value and risk mitigation in that process itself.
The next journey for that too is like we're actually building a tool to digitize our supply chain ourselves. So, I mean, Kirsty can definitely talk to what we're building.
Yeah. So, well, our software is called Apalto, and we have not released it yet. It's a work in progress, but we are working with subcontractors and trying to make the process of especially invoicing easier. And that will also integrate with our current software, which is Gate 3. So we're still trying to figure out the process here. We had a lot of experience with Gate 3 and what worked, what didn't, lessons learned. And now we've set up a whole team that's just working on the software. And we're going from start to finish. We're doing everything, not just the software itself, but we're thinking about how to market it, what value is it for the subcontractor? What value does it bring to us?
And simplifying the process, like we work with thousands of subs across the country, and to give them an opportunity to simplify the payment process and make sure that they're getting paid on time, it's such a critical part of the construction life cycle, right? Like making sure that is always on time for them so that they're able to pay their trades or their people, and anything we can do to make that process less difficult is going to be an advantage for Elliston as well.
Yeah, that's just like MVP one, right?
Yeah.
Like we're thinking of adding a lot more to this software.
Well, it's a powerful piece to help, because you're right. Getting payment is possibly the most critical way to reduce cost over time too, because if you're not paying your trade contractors at the speeds you need to, they are charging you in the end, right? There is finance fees around money. And this is how the cost of construction has escalated so much, is because we know that we're have to build that in. So if I know you're going to pay me for my materials, if you're going to pay me for my labor at a much faster pace, I'm going to give you discounts. I'm going to give you, and you're going to be the one I want to go to work for. Because if it's frictionless to get paid, this is why we work together. Like, so it's powerful. Now you've created all this and you have all this data, right? Tons of data. So I want to finish this out on what is Elliston? What do you two see as the future of the power of this data? Because so much, the statistics are ridiculous. Like 96% of all construction data goes unused. Like we don't use it for anything.
That's a very fair statement, because until recently, we weren't using ours to its, I'm not saying we're fully using it, but we are definitely exploring that mountain. We have a 20-person strong insights and analytics group, which maintains our central data environment and helps us to figure out what to do with it. And the first thing is machine learning. And without historical data, like we've been very regimented in how we track our projects, probably for around 10 to 15 years, we've had really good cost management data and scheduling data and all of these really core aspects to the construction lifecycle process. Without those rules being implemented years ago, machine learning would be off the table. And that's been a really exciting new function for our team, is embedding. We've embedded a few different use cases of machine learning already into our in-house tools, and we're looking at building out more. And that partnership with that group is going to be an essential piece of what makes Gate 3 an even better tool and saves our team's time. So we're looking at risk mitigation, and we're looking at hypothetical scenarios, right? Like optioneering, those types of functions. Things our project teams don't have necessarily time to dig into and think about. So
just optimizing workflow, really.
Exactly.
That's so powerful. And the things I want people listening to hear is that, like, it's 20 years of, you know, so it's 20 people and it's probably 15 years of solid understanding to keep the data clean. So people ask me all the time, like, what do I need to do? You need to get your house in order first, right? Like your data and your structure and what you're capturing. That's the things the AI and others, you can't, they're the base layer for doing it. Without it, you're done. Some people will argue that AI can take unstructured data and put it into a structured fashion and make it reportable. I'll agree in some respects, but I'll also disagree, because what it can't do is create the data that you don't have. If you don't have it in any way, shape, or form,
yeah,
it has nothing to work with. And it's far better and really expensive to use it to organize your data. If your data is organized, then you can use tools like machine learning, analytics, other, I don't want to call them low level, but other, they're not as costly there, and they're just as powerful in many respects. So you can use those. So you have that laid out now. And then 20 people. That's 20 yep. people focused on the power of data itself.
Yep. Data and scientists, data engineers, huge. Data analysts. One of the things we just have to also think about is, you know, we must have a million data points. And I would say to anybody out there who's looking to start this process, don't think about the million. Find your 100 or 200 extremely critical points of information. Understand what systems they're in. Connect those together. Try to build a centralized data language basically between all your different systems. And then on top of that, you want to make sure that you understand the commentary around what those data points mean. So it's fine if, you know, us in the engineering or data group understand what something's supposed to mean, but if the business is using this technology in a different way, your data is not great either. So much of that responsibility relies on our consulting group to make sure that best practices are being used with respect to all these different tools. And that's a full-time job as well. because we might release a product. People might use it in their own way. We expect certain results and they're completely different from what we need. Right. So making sure the tool is intuitive enough to give the user what they're looking for. And then also making sure that the data is matching up with what we expected it to be so that these models are trained the right way. And that is a very long challenge that we still have yet to fully solve, but we're definitely on the way there.
I think this is awesome because you're showing just the depth of investment, thought, and time that it takes to do this. As a construction company, to have a digital group that develops their own tools and works side by side with the business. So I have to thank both of you for sitting down today. This was so much fun. I hope everybody listening understands the depth at which your organization and you two have put into building products and processes and the partnerships with the organization. It's so cool to see because this is what I'm always fighting is it's not done like this in most cases. This is not what people think of. And to be successful at scale, this is what you have to do.
100%. And we're still learning every day. It's honestly every year I'm here. Every month
we're like changing our processes.
We're trying to explore new things. We're trying to learn from our mistakes. We're pushing forward. We're growing. And we're looking to the industry to also teach us always as well, right? We spend a lot of time going on the road, going to conferences, figuring out what the needs are of our peripheral companies. And a lot of us face the same challenges, right? So any lessons that they've learned, we like to see if we can share and just make sure that we're taking construction to the next digital level, right?
That's the way it works. And I would be surprised if it didn't change every month, every 6 months, every year. That's the beauty of construction is changing fast. Technology is changing even faster. And keeping the two together is a full-time job for a lot of people. So obviously that's why, Delastan has invested so much. And I have to thank both of you for sitting down with me. This is so cool because, I've had the construction side on and construction tech side. Now this is sort of we've removed the curtain to show all the workings that go on behind Elliston and what you do. So Kirsty, thank you so much for sharing your expertise today.
Thank you. That was fun.
And Samantha, thank you for putting it together and for both of you for being willing to sit down, but to sit down and talk to me today.
Absolutely, Jeff. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Hey, look Kirsty and Samantha up online. You can also catch them at Elliston or hopefully at a show near you somewhere soon. Thank you for tuning in today to geek out for our interview with Samantha Elric and Kirsty Nurka. To read all our news stories, to learn more about our guests, and to listen to this show, visit thecontactcrew.com. This is The Contact Crew signing out. Until next time, enjoy the ride and geek out.